Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamau Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamau Murray, and we are here with probably the most famous voice in tennis. What? You and Andrew Krasny.
Krasny's amazing.
The most versatile, talented, ambidextrous, served with buck 30 on both sides, righty and lefty. I don't know how that doesn't get him to be number one in the world in singles, but we'll find out how. coach of Syracuse University for 7.5 years, 1993 French Open doubles champion, former world number one junior in singles and doubles in 1984. He is the definition of how to keep the game alive, stay in the game, and bring energy to the game, and bluff your way to a world team tennis championship against Mr. Luke Jensen. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, coach. I thought you gotta say, like, just been living on a scholarship for way too long.
You are like living on a scholarship. I mean, you are everywhere and do everything and have so much knowledge. And one of the things I love about you and your brother is that you're from the Midwest. We hear all this crap. Me, even as a coach now, I hear all this crap that you got to move to Florida, you got to move to California, got to move in Texas. And I like go down the list of all the players that grew up in either New York, Midwest, Kansas City. And like, you can make it being from here. But, you know, it takes some work, right? And you got to be tough. Sure. Everybody's not tough in tennis. We got some softies, right? But you're not one of them. So tell me about growing up playing tennis. And outside of Florida and California, to me, the Midwest section is the toughest section.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So tell me about growing up playing tennis in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah, so we were just blessed. Number one, our life coaches, right? Our parents are the drivers of this bus, and they have a dream to give us an opportunity. And they weren't tennis players. My dad was a football player. My mom was a frustrated basketball player before Title IX. So they were children of parents that grew up in the Great Depression. So knew, you know, blue collar work ethic, sports really wasn't on the radar. So when my parents had children, they wanted to give us an athletic opportunity wherever we wanted to go. So all four of us ended up playing in the Grand Slams. I was very blessed to play with my brother and my two sisters in mixed doubles in all the slams. So that was just amazing considering coming from a very small town. Grand Rapids was really kind of a tennis opportunity. I grew up on a Christmas tree farm with my siblings about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of that. So no indoor tennis, but tennis was booming at that time. This was like the mid to late 70s. It's Borg, McEnroe, Connors. It's tennis houses like Midtown in Chicago was really kind of like the cornerstone of everything in the North, because you had to go through Midtown to be anybody. Right. Because you couldn't play year round, but you could at Midtown. And from Midtown, you started to see like Detroit, Lansing in Michigan, Grand Rapids in Michigan, these tennis houses being built where guys like us could now even the score, if not do better than the Southern states, Florida, Texas, California, because we could go before school, after school, it was raining, snowing, it didn't matter, where the kids in the South, if it rained, they were out of luck. They didn't have indoor places. So we were blessed to be in have a couple of parents that wanted to give us the opportunity. And to be honest, because I had two sisters, my parents saw tennis as our family glue. That was a sport that kept us all together. We could go to tournaments all around the state in the section where we both could play. You know, my sisters could play, we could play. And then family tournaments, my parents played, my grandparents played. So it was really the sport that kept us all together instead of one played football, another one played soccer, another one played something else. Yeah. So it was the one sport that brought us together. And the Midwest values, in my opinion, that mindset to get in the cold, to get out of the van, into a tournament, into practice, really served us well when we start branching out and had to really, you know, fight for our money, fight for our living.
So my wife's family is from Baldwin, Michigan, which is Big Rapids.
Oh, yeah.
I was just in Big Rapids about 10 days ago for like three days.
For like a family reunion or something?
Family event kind of thing. You know, the best hotel was like a 2.5-star. You know what I mean? You're eating at a coffee place called Big B's Coffee. Very quaint, but tough. But I mean, you know, it is sort of that hard nose.
Yeah.
Not a lot of distractions, right? If you have a focus, it's a great place to like dig into yourself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Baldwin's a great spot. So I grew up in Ludington. Keep going on the 10, and you're right there. So Baldwin is some really, you know, tough customers out of Baldwin. Great fishing out of there.
White Cloud.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
You didn't know. See, I get around the Midwest.
I got a speeding ticket because I'm working with Coco Vanderway. So during the Midland tournament, I was going between Midland and Ludington just at my parents' house. And I got a ticket, like, going way too fast. Baldwin police got me. It's a tough corner.
You didn't just pull the "I'm the most famous person from."
That doesn't work. Does not work.
If anybody's driving through Michigan, you all are famous for giving out-of-towner speed tickets. Just FYI.
Especially Illinois. If you have an Illinois plate, you are a target.
Yeah, it's like, you know, y'all are haters. Everyone from Detroit wants to be from Chicago. So you all hold it against us.
That's right.
So anyway, you go to USC.
Yep.
In 86 and 87. And at that time, what I found was very interesting, you didn't spend that long there. Mm-hmm. And like right now, you know, if you win NCAAs, you play at UCLA, you play USC, you look at Creasy and Mackie McDonald, it's sort of, or even Steve Johnson, there's sort of a clear barometer for, all right, I'm going to make a living playing tennis, right? Because you can play 25s, 50s, 75s, all that kind of thing, right? But then it was kind of like you had to take a chance to leave school early, right? And the money wasn't as great where, even if I lose first round of every slam right now, you make $400,000, right? Yeah. It's $100,000 to lose first round.
Yeah.
Back then, it wasn't that. So how did you have the balls to leave so early? Right.
Again, aren't we all blessed to meet certain people in our lives? So I was the number one junior in the world in 84. Ed Berg had already kind of, Greg Krickstein was out of that. So I kind of fell right behind those guys. Boris Becker just won Wimbledon, about to win Wimbledon in 85. So we were all kind of in that junior class. And Arthur Ashe was our Davis Cup captain for the United States. And so he, at the U.S. Open, and he goes, he asks for a meeting. Arthur Ashe asked for a meeting. So I'm believing, no parents, no agents, no anything. Just, I get this a one-on-one with Captain Ashe. It's just amazing. And he was always really involved with all the American players, whether the top pros or the journeymen, or even especially the juniors. He'd come up to us at Wimbledon, and come up to us at all the tournaments that he was at, and just give us encouragement, say, you know, I was watching you practice or watching you play. So he was very much in your kind of rotation. And the way he just conducted himself, the way he spoke to you, you just like stood at attention. You were talked into greatness, and greatness was giving you this advice really kind of from God. And so when he sat down with me, I thought he was going to ask me to join the U.S. Davis Cup team. We had I think we were playing Japan or something like that. So he didn't need McEnroe and Connors and these guys. And he had Krickstein. So I was like, I could be that other guy. Japan's not going to be a tough tie. And I walk in and he sits me down and he asks me if I'm going to turn pro or not. And I go, well, you know, I'm thinking about it. I've got a couple of contracts, this and that could be on the table. And he goes, and I totally didn't know what I was walking into. And he was totally prepared. And he goes, I think you should go to college. And that was the last thing that, you know, I was like, I'm thinking I'm going to be on the U.S. Davis Cup team. And the next thing I'm thinking, now I'm going to college. And he said, well, I went to UCLA. John McEnroe went to Stanford. Connors went to UCLA. Stan Smith went to USC. You need to grow up. You need to get away from home and live away from your parents, whether it's 1 year, 4 years, you know, balance a checkbook. live in an apartment with a tennis guy or a non-tennis guy, and just really taught me, gave me a vision to really do more than just swing forehands and backhands. And he sold it on, how do you plan on making a living on the pro tennis tour? So I'm going to kick everybody's butt. You know, I'm, he goes, what do you, I know it's so embarrassing because I'm so cocky, right? I'm number one, you know, I'm talking to Arthur Ashe. And he's going, how much money have you made? Yeah, as an amateur, you don't make the money, you make expenses. But, right. And so I didn't know. He goes, what's your ranking? Oh, it's 234, Captain Ashe. It's 234. It's like, you know, I'm playing part-time, right. Got the junior stuff. And he's going, well, you've made 16,300. He knew the number to the dollar. And he goes, that's not paying your rent. That's not paying your expenses. Go to college, get better, grow as a person. Because I really think overall you'll be better for it. And your tennis, you know, I said pro. He said pro tennis was always going to be there. The contracts will be there. Just keep winning, keep working hard. But my recommendation is that you go to college. He didn't tell me where to go, but that was really a huge kind of moment for me when Arthur Ashe tells you and gives you advice, you take it. Yeah. And in the end, it was the most important decision I made for myself as a person, because I did everything that he said I was going to do. I was going to, you know, learn in the classroom, learn on the tennis court, because in juniors, you don't get coaching on court. As you know, as a fellow college player, you grow so much when that coach is sitting on your court, helping you navigate, not just how to hit tennis balls, but how to play tennis. And because I had the ability to serve both left-handed and right-handed, I'm so grateful to have this Rick Leach's dad, Dick Leach, was really a tennis genius. His IQ to see things and help me navigate, you know, in pressure situations when we played Stanford and UCLA and Pepperdine and all the big schools. And I got to sit right there with him as he gave me strategies that were like 8-layer chess, like working with Spock on like tennis strategy. And before I just did things athletically, or I just did things, but you know, I'd never been coached before on court until that time. And because of that, I truly believe I became a better tennis player on court. And then socially being in that unbelievable environment in a college setting, I have friends today that I still stay in touch with that were athletes in other sports or just people in general that, if I didn't have that, I don't know the person I'd be today.
So you talk about coaching. Where did the serving with both hands come in? Because, I mean, look, the best female, best women in the world serve at 60%. Yep. Best men in the world are serving 68% first serve percentage. Yep. And then you have the audacity to try to serve with both hands, right? guys are serving, this is people top 10 in the world only making 68% of first serves with one hand. Where did that come from, and how did you find the time? Because I can still get an extra, right? You got forehand, backhand serve, volleys. By the time you're playing indoors in Michigan, a serve with my left hand is extra. That's not, know what I mean? So where'd you find it?
So it's a long story. My dad coached high school tennis. They, you know, just like high school coaches, here's a little sport on the side, make a little extra dough. So I grew up him coaching high school tennis, even though he was a football player and a boxer growing up. So he was kind of learning the sport while I was growing up. So I got to go to all these like clinics and things like that and coaches clinics in the state of Michigan. And so watching, again, back in the 70s, who's starting to dominate? Okay, Vilas is in there. He's lefty. Laver's kind of leaving the scene. He's a lefty. Then there's this guy, John McEnroe, Jimmy Connors, and there's this Czech, Martina Navratilova. All these players like in the top five, and they're like, the way the scoring is, lefties have a big advantage, 15-30, 30-15, add in all the big points and add scoring tennis are in that add side. And what do you know? All these lefties, even though there's not a lot of them, they seem to be winning a lot of these majors. So I grew up playing tennis right-handed because those old wood rackets were so heavy. So I throw left-handed, I kick left-footed. So there was some leftiness in me. So with these major players coming through, my dad said, you know, listen, it's just like throwing a ball. Let's develop both sides, something different, something unique. And because he didn't have a traditional tennis background. And I was working with this guy, Don Dickinson, who's out in Arizona now, but he was my first real tennis coach. They had the vision to like, why not? Even though it's twice as much work to develop it, my game was so far behind in like the 12s and 14s that I was working on everything. So adding a lefty serve was the traditional world of tennis, the establishment saying, no, no one's ever done it. It's a waste of time. Don't do that. But because I was stuck in this iceberg in Northern Michigan, I was working on all this stuff and it really never have to serve into the sun. Overheads on both sides and doubles was huge. And then if I had matchup problems with, let's say someone like Agassi, I could switch it up on him a lot, or Patrick McEnroe had a great backhand. I could go a certain serve. And so I had twice as many pitches as everybody else, which was a huge advantage for me.
So let me ask you this then, because, you know, you watch players play on tour, right? And when that pressure hits, you can say, man, I'd love for you to serve this. Yeah. Let's just make it out the game. Serve the serve you can make.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
You know, did you switch up? Or did you, could you serve both of them well enough to make the lefty under pressure? Or on that ad side, if it's match point or your down break point, did you just go back to the righty? Like, was it equal or was one like my pressure point?
So very fortunate the way the approach was when I was starting to serve left-handed was for the, I think it was the first month for sure, every second serve had to be lefty. So I could hit a first lefty or hit a first righty, but every, at least a month, maybe 2 months, whether it's practice or competition, every second serve have to be lefty. And because I had that approach, or my coaches installed that kind of plan, it became very reliable. Just, you know, how many double faults you got to go through and you just kind of figure it out. And it really became, so, I mean, people ask me this, who I played against, what was your most effective serve? And it's funny talking to the Woodies or talking to the guys I played against, because they thought I had certain serves that I favored, and everyone had different ones. But the one that was always my most reliable, my go-to, was my lefty kick in the tee to a righty with those big Western forehand grips. I could kick it up on them pretty high. Mm-hmm. And if there's one serve that I knew for life or death, that could be the one. But they were both, I mean, they're both as fast in the 130s. But in doubles, you never redline. You want that first serve percentage. So I was, you know, in the 120s consistently with both of them, could kick both of them. They were really, when I was 100% healthy before I found pizza and everything, they're exactly the same. I never felt one was better than the other under pressure.
Got it. That's interesting. And it's interesting to serve a lefty serve to the ad side to a righty's forehand. Right? It's almost like, why bother, right? It's almost it makes sense, right? It's like, damn, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
So one of the things that, you know, I try to explain to people is how different it is singles and doubles.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at like best doubles players in history, you look at Bryan Brothers.
Yep.
You look at the Jensen brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at, you were six in the world in dubs,
mm-hmm.
and career high 163 in the world in singles. Mm-hmm. Yep. Somebody could look at that and say, well, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, if he's six in the world in doubles, maybe he should be 30 in the world in singles.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to the common folks how big of a gap it is and why you think there was such a disparity between the singles ranking and doubles ranking.
Yeah, I mean, it was real easy. So I turned pro in the fall of 87. Out of USC after my sophomore year. And I start working on my ranking. I mean, I'd lost some points because going to college, you're not playing as many tournaments as I was pro tournaments as I was in the juniors. And so it really dropped a bunch. And so I started traveling to Europe, going to South Africa to play. You know, you find those points where the weakest tournaments, staying in the States was not smart. So within the first, I think, 3 or 4 months, by the end of 87, I got to about 160s, 168 in singles, 163 in doubles. I was like right in there. Somewhere, both of those rankings kind of came up at the same time playing those minor league tournaments. So now I'm going into 88, and I just want to continue the same thing because the money's in singles. So in that 88 year, my doubles, I win a couple of tournaments in dubs, singles doesn't really play out. And then, as you know, the gold standard to a professional tennis player, the money's great, obviously, but it's the points. And that 12 month, you're always defending, right? You're always defending. And so I started to peel off those points I won in 87 in the fall, started really coming up real fast. And my singles wasn't really winning. I had those like the sophomore freshman blues. Everybody knew the lefty righty guy and stuff like that. But in doubles, I kept winning matches. So going into 89, now my doubles is top 100. Okay, do you want to make money, stay in nice hotels, play the major tournaments, which would be you're just playing doubles, or singles, you go back to the minor leagues and grind it out for another, what, 1 year, 2 years with no guarantee you're making money. So it was a big thing on my mind because I wanted to start making money. And my parents had three other kids they were putting through juniors and college and everything. And so who wanted to be pro tennis players? So my number one thing was as soon as I could get a paycheck, the biggest paycheck, I was doing that. So I tried to play this game, doubles main draw, and then qualifying at these Memphis and Philly and majors, but I couldn't bridge that gap. I couldn't really jump it. I did well. I had some wins. I beat Agassi in Memphis in 96. Krajicek in 96, he won Wimbledon. I almost got him lost to like Breaker in the third or something like that. But for the most part, doubles was paying the bills. And that's where I kind of separated from there, whereas you have to commit one or the other. And to me, and then when Murphy got on and we started doing well, that was really our gravy train.
So Tim, speaking of Murph, tell me about that 1993 French Open.
Oh,
and that's classic.
Yeah.
Classic. Right.
It's amazing.
The stuff that happens off the court, right? During a slam run.
Yeah.
And the things that almost go wrong that don't go wrong during a slam run.
Yeah.
It's just like sort of like in the tennis graveyard, untold stories. Tell us about that.
So I want to ask you. So it's the same thing. When you go back to the year you got Sloan to cross the finish line and win the US Open. Do you still have dreams about that you're still in that battle? Because I do about 93. I will wake up and I'm like, we're still in the tournament and we're like, is this real? Did it really happen? Because that 2 weeks, as you know, every match and the day between and how you prepare and looking back is just, it's a miracle. Like, it's how did I get here? It's a miracle.
I mean, I think of 2017. 900 in the world.
Yep.
Couple good tournament, good tournament in Montreal or Toronto. I'm sorry. Good tournament in Toronto. Good tournament in Cincy. Going to the US Open. Six of the seven matches she played were against the seed.
Yeah.
The only unseeded player she played was in the first round with Berta Vinci.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last year, right?
Yeah.
US Open.
Yeah.
And Roberta Vinci will just chop you up, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
People think the backhand's weak, but for a woman who likes a straightforward match, I'd rather just play her forehand.
Absolutely.
She's not going to slice and dice and drop you. She's not going to be as creative off that side. Let's just feed her forehands, right? So first set, first round, we're playing a forehand. It sounds like, 7-6. Like, it's not this is like hard. It's hard, but we won that set. Had you played her backhand, she'd have chipped you here, chipped you there, dropped you. I was like, trust me, that's it. Then you play Sibakova, and Sibakova, it was like literally 6-4 in the third on like court 12.
Yep.
And that probably was, in every slam run, there's a match you should have lost.
Right, right.
That was a match we should have lost. Let me tell you, the match is over, Sloan wins, walking from court 12, maybe it was like court 8, past the bar.
Yeah.
Where they're serving the honey deuces.
Right, of course. Yeah, the Heineken.
Sibakova's husband team don't even go to the locker room. They don't go to the stretch room. They stop and have a drink. And I walked past them and they said, that was a good match. You need to have a drink with us. And I did the same thing. So I stopped and I had a drink with them.
She was
in the room on the bike. She's like, where were you? And I was like, sorry, I had to have a drink. I was like,
So but good.
I mean, you're thinking like those matches and like trying not to get food poisoning in New York.
Yep.
Trying not, but I mean, I didn't sleep the whole 2 weeks.
That's amazing.
You know, I didn't sleep because you're trying not to mess it up, right? You're like,
yeah, right. Yeah.
On a run. Let me watch 30 more minutes of YouTube. Let me look at these stats for one more hour. And before you know it, I mean, literally, I remember Sven, right? So Sharapova had to play a match. Sharapova played a match. We played a match at the same time. So we're in the gym on the fourth floor, warming up. And I was like, I said, hey, good luck, Sven. And then he was like, we don't need luck, you do. And then she ended up losing that match. I remember that. And she ended up losing, Sharapova ended up losing, because that was Sloan's next match.
Yeah.
And it was like, we don't want to play Sharapova, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So Sharapova ended up losing that match. And I was like, thank God. But I remember like being in the shower on many nights and just sitting on the floor of the shower. Because again, I didn't play, you know, pro tennis.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm definitely like batting above my weight class at the time, right? You know what I mean? Yeah, and I think I knew what I was doing. I was a great statistician. She and I had great chemistry. But it was like, man, like we're like fucking in the court of the slam. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're like, everyone's going home and we're like the only ones here. So I definitely was getting the like, whoa, what's happening? Let me just lock in, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. And then like I had this sweatshirt that I wore for the whole 2 weeks and it stunk so bad. It stunk.
You can't wash it. No. You
can't wash it, right?
No.
So tell me about 93, because I know so- the story.
Same thing. So Murphy and I started play in 93 as pros. He's 2.5 years younger. He stayed 3 years longer in school while I was out there just working on my ranking and doing the pro thing. And so when he turned pro in 90, he had to go through the minor leagues too. So he's playing in all these small places. And I'd join him from time to time, but I was top 10 at the time with another guy, this guy, Laurie Warder from Australia. And after 92, Laurie and I split up because Murphy and I always had a dream to play on the tour together. And this was our moment. He had I think he was in the top 100 at that point in doubles. And so we could get into most of the tournaments and we start out and we did okay. We got the semis of Sydney, I think first or second round of the Australian, doing okay, but no real breakthroughs. So going into the clay court season, we got into this like losing streak in it came down to Hamburg and we lost 8 tournaments in a row, first round. And I got points coming off all over. I've got finals of Rome, one in Bologna, quarters of the, you know, so as you know, you start adding up those chips that are both about to fall off like dominoes. And we'd lost all these matches, 8 matches. And that's a long time to just go 0-for. And 3 sets, up match points, and 0-0, all different ways. And we just couldn't figure it out. And after the match, we just stayed on the court. We're the last match on field court. And he's going, listen, I don't want to ruin your career. If you know, you're about to lose all these points, it's not working out. And it was one of those moments where I was the big brother. And I said, Murphy, we're going to do this. I don't care if we're back playing the satellites and the futures. I don't care where we are in South America and we've got to figure it out, but we're going to do it. I believe in you. We've always had this dream to do it. And it kind of gave him kind of the wind in the sail that he needs to really keep going, because he had never been at this level before. He'd played, you know, college and juniors and small pro stuff, but this is the big boy stuff. And so the next week we get to the semis of Rome, finals of Bologna, which is a warm-up tournament for the French. And then we get to the French and because we did well the week before, it's like a Sunday before they played the French, that first day on Sunday. So nobody was around, real quiet. And we're sitting there and I said to Murphy, you know, we could win this tournament. We can win it. Like you know, 6'4", big, tall lefty, big serve. We can hold serve. We got something here. And he looks at me, he goes, what are you talking about? I've never even been to Paris. And so I said to him, you just have to just have so much fun with this, because through everything, like we shouldn't even be here. Like we're not seated and we just came off of this losing streak. We got a little something going and he just thought I was out of my mind. So we get to the first round the next day and we're down match points. Guy serves to me. I hit a return. I break a string. So the guy, like, wisely volleys back to me, and you make a choice, right? When you break a string, do I throw up a high defensive lob? They were both at the net, so I just couldn't run to the net. So he volleys back to me, and I just threw it. I'm just going to go for it. And it goes in, and we win the point. And so it's like, but we end up winning that match 12-10 in the third. The second round, we're down match points. We win 12-10 in the third. Third round, we're down 5-3 in the third. Murphy and I are fighting against each other on the court, and rain comes. The tennis gods give us a little break. Well, I know they pull the covers. It's going to be fast. I get on the phone with our United Airlines because I know this match is going to be over in like 40 minutes. I can be at the airport, Charles de Gaulle, on a plane back to the States. And all of a sudden, there's this tug on my jacket. And it's our mom, 6'2", not messing, our mama bear, right? She's pissed. She's got Murphy 6'4" in one hand. She got me by the collar in the other hand. And she's banging our heads together, work together. Just shut up and play, you know, doing what mama bear does. So we get out there, we end up winning 7-5 in a third. So now we're in the quarters, and we got to play LeConte and Ivanišević. Ivanišević, huge lefty serve. LeConte, this French guy, loved the crowd and everything. So we're in the, you know, second week, and this, I didn't know which player it was, but someone said, if you guys win this thing, you got to have a celebration. You got to, you know, Borg goes to his knees. Pat Cash goes up to the player's box. You got to do something. And for whatever reason, I just said, remember, this is the like middle Saturday or Sunday. I said, if we win this thing, I'm going to body slam Murphy to the ground like big time wrestling. And it'll be the greatest celebration of all time. And everyone's like joking about it. Yeah, give me a break. There, you know, we still have three matches. There's no way we're supposed to win this or are going to win this thing. So we get out there and we're playing on the old bull ring at the court one.
Yeah, court one. Old
fans are right on top of you. It's no longer there, but it was a great place to play. And the fans are all French and they're bananas. And every time LeConte would hit the ball, the fans would go, yay. And when Murphy and I would hit the ball, they'd go, boo, yay, boo, the whole 5 minute war. It's just the warm-up. So we end up losing. I think the first set, end up coming back tiebreaker and then winning in the third. So another match we probably should have lost. Now we get to the semis, and it was the only time we won in straight sets. We beat Korda, Peter Korda, and Stefan Edberg. So another quality wins in there, but not really like doubles guys. Edberg was the last guy to be number one in singles and doubles since like McEnroe. So, you know, like he could play, but those guys, you know, it's like playing doubles guys and we're hyping up like college players. We're in the semis of the French. We're winning this thing. We're on center court and Chatrier. So now we're in the finals and it's unbelievable. I mean, it's, as you know, that locker room is a quiet place from 2 weeks before, and every bag and every coach and every parent, it's like you're climbing over humanity and all of this stuff to, it's just you and just them. And we didn't have a coach and they had a coach. We played these two German guys who were also unseated, but they beat the Woodies. They beat all these seated guys. And we kind of navigated through some singles guys and stuff. And so it was, could have been a first round match. Instead, it's two unseated teams. We're sitting in the locker room waiting for Steffi Graf was playing Mary Jo Fernandez. So we're just waiting it out. And it's, as you know, it's the worst. Just give me a time. Is it noon? Is it 3? Because you don't know when to, you know, warm up. When do I eat? Now it goes 3 sets. Got to eat again. Got to warm up again. So these two German guys and their coach, who's German, speak perfect English. And as we're sitting there waiting for this match to end, Johnny Mack comes through. He's not calling the women's final. He's calling our final on NBC with Bud Collins. Now, I knew Johnny Mack forever because I played doubles in the juniors with Patrick. And then when I was at USC, I used to practice with John when he lived in Malibu. And then in 91 and 92, the 2 years prior, I was on the Davis Cup team as a hitting partner, hanging out with those guys. So I knew John really well. Murphy didn't know him that well. And John comes in because he, you know how much he loves to practice. Mm-hmm. He goes in before, he's always hitting balls. So he's coming through the locker room about to go practice and he stops and he goes, he gives us one of these like General Patton speeches. I want you to take these guys back to the beaches of Normandy. Now it's the day before the 49th anniversary of D-Day. And it's a big deal in France, you know, like France was liberated and all this stuff. So he starts going, and I want you to take them back there and kick their ass and this whole like huge, like motivational speech. And the whole time I'm thinking, these Germans, I mean, they're 10 feet away. Perfect English. They weren't even alive for D-Day. And McEnroe's just going off. Murphy is going, why is John McEnroe yelling at me? And so then as soon as he got in there and like yelled at us, he left. And we're like, what just happened? But it took the edge off. Like we were more like concerned with what the hell John McEnroe just said. Then, oh, we got to go out. But I do remember specifically that I never thought I ever had to win a tennis match. My parents were just awesome with all of us because it was always based on effort and enthusiasm. Like go out and have fun. I don't care if you lose 0-0. If you come off and your knees are bloody from diving on the court, you know, I'm going to give you a big giant squeeze, one of our hugs, and we'll go grab some ice cream. We're going to have a fun time. But you could win 0-0, but if you're distracted, acting like a knucklehead, they would light us up. They would just rip us. So I never felt I had to win a match until then, because I thought, you know what? I may never get here again. This is our moment. And I didn't say that to Murphy. I mean, he was total rookie and didn't know really anything, but I could serve big and go for winners. And so I remember specifically, like, this is our moment right now, because it may not happen again. So we get out there, we win the first set, lose the second in the tiebreaker, and Murphy's distraught. He's like, dude, I'm so sorry. He's so sorry because he felt he let me down. I said, Murphy, we've been match points down this whole tournament. We shouldn't even be here. And so we get down 0-1, 0-2, 0-3 in the third. Now I'm serving, which is the most important moment of my life, because I know we dropped that serve.
Done.
We're done. Double break. So I just remember specifically still to this day, like waking up in the middle of the night, like I'm thinking about that game, hold that game, first serve percentage, make the volley, just real basic. They can beat us, but I can't fumble right now.
Right.
We go to 3-1, 3-2, we break. So now we get like some momentum going, and we get to a point where now Murphy's serving 5-4 for the match, serving for the championship.
Little bro.
And yeah. So big serve, 15 love. Big serve overhead, 30 love. So as you know, in doubles, we huddle together. Server's the quarterback. Server says, sets up the point. Okay, I'm going to serve here. You fake, you cross. So for our entire lives playing together, we huddle up and it's just business. Serve and what the net players play is. And Murphy says, whatever you do, don't hurt me. And I go, what are you talking about? And I can see it on tape. It's unbelievable. Whatever you do, don't be stupid and hurt me. And I go, Murphy, we haven't won anything yet. We're zero. And double faults, gets a little tight, bricks a volley. So now I know, listen, I've got to cross. I don't care. Like if he gets that serve in, I got to take off.
Going.
So he gets the serve in at deuce. I take off, and the guy, this Gollner, couldn't believe his luck. Like both Murphy and I were on one side of the court because I left so early. He flags it and shanks it, match point. So now we have match point. Murphy tells me where he's going. He gets his first serve, and I reach. I just take off, but I can't get to it. And now I'm kind of out of position. Murphy makes the volley. I shuffle back into position, and they lob over Murphy. So I'm kind of setting up, get ready for him to smash the overhead. And all of a sudden he goes, yours. And I'm like, yours. So I'm like scrambling. And so at this point, I'm not going to miss. I may lose the point. I may lose the day, but I'm not going to be guy live the rest of my life as I missed an easy overhead on match point at a major. So right. I put it right down the middle. They put another one up over Murphy. He says yours. I get a knock it down the middle. And then Prentisil tries to rip a really, he went into a brain cramp because he rips a forehand from deep behind the baseline. He misses. We win. Unbelievable. We just win the major. I go down and like in a, like a, in a, like a crouching position. And I go to hug Murphy. Well, he's 6'4". He's coming down to get me. As I come up out of this squat, I clock him with a forearm. And you see it on the film. And his, I break his jaw.
No.
I break, hand to God, I break his jaw. And he like, now he can't feel his face. Probably a concussion. But he's like, he can't feel anything. And all of a sudden, we're just around the service line. The German guys, our opponents, are walking up to the net to shake hands. Fans are going crazy. And Murphy's yelling every bad word you can imagine. I told you not to hurt me. You say he thought he was bleeding, but he couldn't feel anything. So that you could see it on tape. The German guys looking at us go, what is wrong with these two guys? We're the ones who lost. And so Murphy's so pissed off at me. Rah, 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 rah. He grabs his bags and starts walking off the court. The tournament director says, Monsieur Murphy, Monsieur Murphy. He's like, what? You must pick up the trophy. So he slams his bags down. And back in the day, you used to have to climb these stairs to the president's box and everything. So it's red carpet. So he walks like he's the singles player. I'm with the two German guys who just lost. So he walks up there, grabs the trophy. Now, in every doubles championship in the history of tennis, there's a beautiful picture. One guy's on one side, the other player's on the other, partner's on the other side, and they hold it up, and it's a great moment. Murphy takes our trophy, holds it up in the air like he just won the singles, and I've got three fingers on the trophy. I'm on my tippy toes, and that's all I got. That's the only time I got to touch that trophy because he was so mad at me. I've taken this thing, and that's our French Open story.
Oh man, let me tell you that place. I mean, we talk about the French Open in Paris, right? Roland Garros in Paris. I remember 2018. You get to the finals.
Yep.
And we leave the stadium, and all of a sudden, the police are following us. I'm like, I mean, what did we do something? I mean, what's going on? So they follow us all the way to the hotel. No one told us that the two finalists get security between the between the semis and the finals.
Yeah.
So now we got security following us all the way home. They're cutting us off. I'm like, are they chasing us? Or are they like, you know, trying to protect us? They get to the hotel like, oh, we're going to be here the whole time. So then they come into the hotel. All right, now we got it. So they come into the hotel. One guy's outside the hotel. One guy's sitting on our floor, just leaning against the wall all night. So, you know, me and Sloan, this is during the 2018 French Open, me and Sloan never went to dinner. Not one night.
So like just room service. Just room service.
No, she would go without me. So I think we went there one night to get some Korean barbecue.
Yeah, yeah.
And after that, it was her and her mom and her friend. We did not go to dinner. We went to practice. Went to matches, came back, she did her own thing. I would eat and I would go to Miss Cole. Miss Cole, like almost every night, got me a little drink, everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And I leave out. So, you know, I leave out by 11 o'clock, can't sleep because, you know, you're up still doing business in the state.
Yeah.
And I go, he said, sir, where are you going? I said, I'm going to have a drink.
Yeah.
He's like, you can't do that. I'm like, I'm not going to be able to sleep if I don't have a drink. I said,
yeah.
You know what I'm dealing with in the other room? Come on, I gotta have a drink, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, oh, sir, I need to come with you. I said, okay, well, come on. You know, so he follows me down there, stands on the corner where Miss Cohen is. It was like, what is going on? But I mean, that is just a classic venue. And that was the last women's match played on Chartrier before
So did it make you more nervous having those guys? Because that would kind of freak me out.
You know what it was like? Wow, this is a whole business, right? Nothing is going to happen to these two players.
Oh,
now in the final.
Yeah.
There's money, there's history, there's that.
But danger.
How crazy the country is over tennis.
Yeah.
When they would like come to the hotel or follow a player or kidnap a player. I'm like, oh, boy, like, should we be concerned kind of thing? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was like, whoa, okay, let's kind of like get this right. But you know, it was kind of cool. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like to feel like in this country, at this moment, this player is so important to what's about to happen here. So it was the French Open is like an event like no other.
Oh yeah, no, it's unbelievable.
I mean, cold rain.
So what were the tell me about the difference, because we talked about the high of winning a U.S. Open. No one ever really talks about your seat being in that situation where now your player just lost and you got to pick up the pieces because, I mean, you're right there, right?
Yeah.
Talk about that, because I think that is so interesting.
So, you know, I think a good coach always tries to take blame.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to think about, you know, did something I missed? Mm-hmm. I should have said something. So, you know, we were up a set in 2-0, right? And so you're kind of sitting there, you don't try to like overreact because you don't want the player to panic. But then if you lose that match, you say, I should have got up and walked out. You know, I should have did something to change the energy. Or maybe I should have yelled something. Maybe I should have said this. Maybe I should have given a signal and just and just took the penalty. You know what I mean? If I said this at like 2:45, I mean, I would have got a warning, but we would have won the game. You know what I mean? So you start to think about everything you did wrong or everything you thought to say but didn't say.
Because
it's like there's 10 things I could say, right, about this match and about what we should be doing. And you got to choose 3 or 4.
Yeah, yeah.
The most important things. And then you just hope that the thing you don't, that you choose to leave out, that you think that they'll figure that out on their own. I don't need to say it. It doesn't come back to mind. So I think it was a low moment for me because I took a lot of responsibility in terms of, I could see the energy going the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, cause I think that year Hallett must've bought 2,000 tickets. It was so many Romanians. I mean, I was where did all these Romanians come from? Right. I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, there's no way that there's this many, right? There's way. Right, that they managed to get tickets.
So
I felt like I probably could have done something more dramatic, like walk out. Like, I'm so pissed off, I'm gonna walk out the stadium. Yeah, and she's like, I can't believe he left. You know what I mean? Think about that. So I think that was it. But then you got to like recover.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, and I don't think we recovered that well. Went to, you know, Wimbledon, lost first round, didn't do anything City Open. And then got it back together, kind of, you know, U.S. Open quarters, year-end championship kind of thing. So I think we kind of got it back together.
Yeah.
But it was a hard one, you know what I mean? Because the thing with tennis, you win one slam, people say, oh, that was a fluke.
Yeah. Oh,
They got lucky, right? Yeah. You win two on two different surfaces, it's kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
That person is going to go to the Hall of Fame, right? And you,
Try to help. Right. Yeah.
You want to try to help that player sort of get that. So that's hard. And I think the lowest point was between after U.S. Open 2017, Sloan lost 10 matches in a row. Right? Remember that right before Miami? Lost 10 matches in a row, and then she comes back with Miami, and that kind of led us to the French Open. I mean, that's low, because then you start to get all the bettors who are sending death threats on Instagram.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
You suck as a coach. You should kill yourself. You should kill her. I mean, it was like, bro, it's just a tennis match, right? That kind of thing, right? Then you start to question yourself as a coach, because now the family are like, oh, maybe you need to switch coaches. You know, maybe the media, maybe they need to switch coaches. Maybe she needs a new voice, maybe that. And it's just like, no, we just, the hiccup, right? Yeah. The hangover.
Grandstand
hangover kind of thing, right?
Absolutely,
But luckily, between, I would say, U.S. Open and, you know, Miami, stuck with the program. Eventually, we figured it out. And it ended up being number 3 in the world the next year. But if you panic after that, maybe 2018 doesn't happen. So I think that was sort of the low for me. It's like, damn, we were so close. I should have said this. Yeah. I knew that was going to happen. I should have said this, or I should have walked out and like made a scene or something.
Made a scene.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, so it's that kind of thing.
People don't understand. And they say, oh, you know, you can coach now on the tour. It's like, you don't understand. It's one thing when you're in a player's box in a big court, but you're on the side courts. Like, you have a couple of words at the most, and you don't want the other side to hear it. So they're not that close to you.
Yeah.
So like you said, you got to pick your phrases, and your timing has to be spot on.
Yeah. So you coached at Syracuse. You coached women, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things, like you hear on tour, you hear the guys, coaches, the guy, people who coach guys sort of laugh at the coaches that coach girls. They're like, we coach tennis and you guys coach emotions. Yeah. How was your experience coaching Syracuse women for 7.5 years?
No, what's great is that I got to recruit the players. So if anything went south, it was on me. I didn't do enough homework and recruit the right player. Because we're in a snow belt, I mean, I used to have recruiting trips. They'd come in February because I really wanted, whether they came from, especially Florida or California, Texas, like, okay, if you're really interested here, this is what you're living. It's not August. This is February in Syracuse, New York. And the university turns the heat off when we practice to save money. Like, you can see your breath indoors. If you want to come here, you got to be a certain type of caliber of kid that is tough, that is different. We made them serve in volley, first and second serve. So I was blessed because I love the recruiting aspect. I take 2 years on each kid to really kind of, is this the right kid that can fit in and prosper and do well? The academics too, we had a great athletic department that helped these kids succeed academically. So when they were doing well in the classroom, they always had great practices. When they weren't doing well in school or they're behind with papers or a test they weren't prepared for, they always tanked out. So I think the best thing I did, I just said, empowered them. Hey, if you need the day, if you need the week, take it off, get this right, and then come back. Because we were, at that point, we weren't in the ACC, we're in the Big East. So we weren't playing like heavyweights all the time. So giving those young adults the empowerment, so listen, coach, have the trust. Hey, you need it, take it. But when you come on the court, I need your 100%, you know, 2 or 3 hours. And I really got the most out of them. And I didn't look at them as men or women. I grew up in a situation, my mom was a gymnastics coach as a phys ed teacher. So I grew up learning about the work ethic that women go through, especially young gymnasts, that sport's brutal gymnastics. And so I really have a lot of respect. My mom was a very towering, passionate, powerful personality. So I respected women and what they go through to be elite athletes. So I really enjoyed the experience. And to this day, I mean, I've got a couple players where I'm the godparent of their kids, their doctors and lawyers, to see them graduate where they were just a freshman that didn't know anything. And now they've graduated and they're getting their diploma. It's unbelievable to see them grow. Now, the same thing, you know, when you see kids thrive in your system, that's the win. Not the Grand Slam title or anything. It's that they're winning in life and they're happy. And if you make them happy, you know, they can do anything.
Now, you've been very generous with your time, but I cannot let you go without talking about Greenbrier World Team. And I'll be honest with you, you know, because talk about probably the most insecure, like, sort of moment on tour for me was, you know, I didn't play on tour. I never won. I didn't win a 93 French Open, you know, so you get to World Team Tennis and you got John Lloyd, JL, yourself, and all these coaches that played on tour, right? And now it's like, now we got to coach a team against each other. So now I got it. That was my first year coaching team tennis. And we get to the final. And we had you all beat. I mean, yeah, it was done. It was done. I think we got a little bit, we got a little tight at the end. What were you thinking? Because y'all were done. And then you start your wooden racket, the hat, slapping five. You started totally bluffing your team into believing that you all could come back. What were you thinking during that time?
You know what? Well, first, I remember our first coaches meeting. Remember coaches only that we had in that indoor place? And I'm telling you, we all had our questions and things about, you know, the league and COVID. We had all these restrictions, right, with the bubbles and practices and stuff. But, you know, I really wanted to stress to you is that how all of us so respect you and the way you communicate with your players. I mean, you'd already won your slam and Sloan was, you know, obviously so gifted and talented, but also respected. This is all, you guys earn that respect. Just because we played doesn't mean you're going to be a great coach or a great communicator. If to be a great coach, you're a great listener. You know exactly to say the right things. And the other thing is, you take responsibility. A lot of coaches like, listen, screw you, the player, you screwed it up. But you said it earlier, you put a lot of that stuff on you that allows the player who's already hurting already to like, okay, it's not as bad as, you know, losing this or losing that. And so sitting in there, you were a giant with us. You were a huge part of the success of World Team Tennis that season. And it proved your team played great to get there. And to manage those personalities, woo. I mean, that's what I mean. And all the stories in the back, like that's a real, if World Team Tennis did a reality TV thing on that, that would have sold to Netflix. Forget
Netflix
what they're doing
came
now.
That year. That was great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, let's start with that. Just how much we all truly respect you and your wisdom in the game and how much you give to the game and you make a difference. And so when we played, my feeling always was with that whole team, because when you're playing with, when you're coaching pros, it's so different from college where you have control of the scholarship and you recruit them. You know, you pay these players way more than you're getting paid and they're kind of running the show. And so how do you kind of navigate that where it's not an exhibition, but we're playing for a lot of money. And so I just call this always like team awesome. We're going to have more fun than everybody else. I don't care if we lose, we win. I just want the other side to know and the fans to know we have more fun than ever, more high fives than everybody. We're smiling. I got the wood racket and all this stuff. And so when we got to that final, I just thought it was amazing because it was the women's doubles that you pulled out, that you wanted to finish strong and you felt most confident with your women's doubles. That was your call in the lineup. And I felt really good with Vanderway and
Melikar.
And Melikar, Nicole Melikar, because I mean, two powerful players, they had to come back. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on and I just wanted them smiling, having fun in that weird format. Anything can happen. Anybody can get a little tight. And I thought Jeannie got a little tight, you know, and all of a sudden you made the move by throwing Sloan in there. And I thought when it got to the tiebreaker and I knew that our time on TV was going into like this golf, it was like 1.4, 1.5 million people were watching this and it was women's tennis. And it was I didn't see anybody like make errors. Yeah. Everybody was hitting. I mean, Sloan came in, winner, ace, vol. I was like, holy, I mean, it was the best tennis at the right time. And I was just so amazed. And so Sloan goes with that ace at 6-all.
Yeah.
Five all or whatever it is. Yeah. Yeah. Boom, ace to the tee. And so, you know, as you know, I love that format for that because of COVID, no ball kits. So being on the court, I love that we could get the ball for him, that little mini huddle that we all have. I love that because it really shows a different side of tennis that normally you don't see. You can really help that player navigate the moment, the situation. And Coco was, I want it. You know, when a player has that Michael Jordan, nobody else is getting the ball. Nobody else is taking the shot. I'm taking the shot. And that's who you want. So you have Sloan, who's a Grand Slam champion, Bethany Maddox-Sands, who's a Grand Slam champion, Nicole Melikar is a Grand Slam champion, and Coco Vanderway is a Grand Slam champion, says, I'm taking it. Not I want, you know, usually going, who wants it? No, there was no doubt. And so it's like, as you know, you just back off. You want it, you take the shot. And it was just, to me, just hyping everybody up. Like, it is magical to come down to one deciding point. Never happened in tennis history. So much on the line. And you got your player wants it. No matter what, you ride with that player. And I call her Clutch because of that. That's her nickname I've given her, a Clutch Vanderway. And she told me she felt that someone was going to go right back there, right where she ate that ace, right down that tee. And she sat on it. and she knew Bethany was going to cross. You know, as a doubles player, you're always going to nibble. You're going to nibble a little bit. And she just rifled it down the line. And it was the only time, I'll never forget this, because it was that hesitation on that call with the Hawkeye. And I was like, oh my God, it's the only time this thing is going to glitch. Did someone turn the power off or something? And, you know, it was a micromillimeter or whatever. A human eye would have called it out. If it was a 100%. Human out there, you guys
would have been out. 100%. And that was $100,000. That was a lot of money.
I was darn right.
That was probably the, if anyone listens to this podcast and you did not see that, I would go to YouTube and watch that tiebreaker.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the best world team tennis moment. Yeah. I mean, evident of the viewership. I mean, so many people that I know don't watch tennis.
Yeah.
Have to be tuning in for the golf.
Yeah.
And end up watching tennis. It was so great. And I would say, as a coach, I always think about, should I left Jeannie in and maybe she would have figured it out? I was like,
No. You gave her, you have to pull her. That's your job. That's what I mean. You could, if you don't put in Sloan, that is your player. You're done. You're and done. Remember, if you remember, I learned this through, especially in college, that you got to put in the best player.
Yeah.
What it's singles, doubles, whatever. And so when I see, if you remember the very first, you had us playing mixed first and Jack got us in that position. He played three sets every single match that second week just to get us in there. And then we had this trade to get Melikar and Vanderway. Yeah. And so in the mix, because Jack had played so much, I didn't have him in the mix. So I just thought, Neil Skupski, you know, you're going to play and then give Jack just two sets. Give me whatever you got. And it was a little overcast at the beginning of that match. So Jack comes to me and says, if you want me to play, I can play. So I substitute. If you remember that, I pulled Neil out of there, put Jack in. And like, I always feel you got to play your best player. And I felt you did the right thing because Sloan was chomping at the bit. Sloan was like, get me in there. Get me in. Like, she was like going nuts. And, you know, again, you're watching the other side. I'm watching this. I'm like, please don't put her in there. Please don't put in Sloan.
To make three first serves. So she came in and had to serve three times.
Yeah.
And made three first serves. I was like, that's why I put you in. Grand Slam champion. You know, first round Sloan is different. But when it's in the final, she always shows.
She's money. She's money. She's a badass. And she, like, it's time to shine. The biggest, brightest lights. I feared her getting on that court. And I was like, holy crap. She took over. Like the whole thing flipped right there. And magical.
I mean, that last 10 minutes of tennis was just magical.
And everybody's like, so engaged, right?
Just screamed belief in your team. Cause you could see him kind of like when Jack got beat 5-0 by B9, you could see the team kind of go down. I was like, that's why he's a good coach. That's why he's on ESPN. That's why he's
You're doing the same thing. It's the, you know what I mean? If you don't do it, if we don't do it as coaches, they're already down. They're feeling it. If we don't take on that responsibility and rev them up, you still may lose, but you got to go down swinging and just staying. We're going to have more fun than everybody else. Just keep going. And that format is just so awesome. I wish college tennis would do it. I really, I wish it would be co-gender and do exactly the same thing, put it in basketball arenas and things, because you could get some serious traction as far as viewership and then attendance at those campuses. Because that was unbelievable. That NOAD scoring and stuff is just amazing. Yeah.
Well, man, I want to thank you, man. You're a legend. I love the energy that you bring to every facet of the game, whether it's commentating, whether it's clinics at the charity events or with the kids or coaching. It's just amazing. I don't know where you find the energy, but I want to just tell you the world respects you. The tennis world respects you. And good luck with Coco, your new assignment. I can only imagine the F-bombs that are dropped on your court with her, you know. So hats off to you for dealing with Coco.
She's awesome. We have so much fun. Yeah, we have we have a bunch of stuff coming up. NFL, so she follows her Chargers. You know, yeah. I follow my Detroit Lions. And so, I mean, she's 31 now, and she's been to all the dances. She's been on all the rides, and it's no BS. We go out there. She works her tail off first thing in the morning, put in 2-a-days, and we're just cutting out the clay court season. Not going to do the clay.
I know.
Go for the French. Go for the paycheck. And go right to the grass, baby.
Roger Federer style, baby. Roger Federer style. You
That's know. Right. That's right.
Well, this has been the Tennis.com podcast with the land, the myth, the legend, Lou Jensen. Thank you for joining, brother.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you.